Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. All of it brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Right now, Three Martini Lunch listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/martini. ZipRecruiter.com/martini. Much more on that a little bit later in the podcast. Jim, let's start with the good martini as usual. And what a difference a new Secretary of State makes from everything we've learned over the past year plus of the Trump administration. One of the people trying to convince Trump to stay in the Iran nuclear deal was former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. The new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, had no such problem encouraging the president to get out, which he did very shortly after Pompeo took office. And now today at the Heritage Foundation, Secretary Pompeo laying out the plan forward when it comes to Iran. And basically, it's kind of the prediction Mr. T gave in Rocky III. It's pain, economic pain, that is. And that is going to be in the form of crippling sanctions. We'll talk a little bit more about the conditions for getting out of the sanctions in a moment. Right now, here's a bit of what Pompeo expects to happen coming up soon.
We will apply unprecedented financial pressure on the Iranian regime. The leaders in Tehran will have no doubt about our seriousness. Thanks to our colleagues at the Department of Treasury, sanctions are going back in full effect and new ones are coming. Last week, we imposed sanctions on the head of Iran's central bank and other entities that were funneling money to the IRGC Quds Force. They were also providing money to Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations. The Iranian regime should know that this is just the beginning. The sting of sanctions will be painful if the regime does not change its course from the unacceptable and unproductive path it has chosen to one that rejoins the League of Nations. These will indeed end up being the strongest sanctions in history when we are complete.
Now, it's possible for Iran to get out of the sanctions. Here's Pompeo's list of 12 basic requirements, according to the AP. He says Iran must stop enrichment of uranium and never pre-process plutonium. Iran must allow unqualified access to all sites throughout the country in terms of the nuclear program. And Pompeo says Iran must also release all U.S. citizens and support for Houthi rebels in Yemen, withdraw all forces from Syria, and stop threatening Israel. Ed Morsi over at Hot Air points out that's not likely to happen probably on any of those fronts, but it is, more importantly, a message to the other members of the old Iran deal. So, Jim, what do you make of this?
You know, Greg, when the Obama administration put forth the Iran deal, very much of their message was, look, it's either this or it's all out war. Right. If you don't support our plan, well, what's your plan? What other ideas possibly could there be? The only other option is full-on war with a nuclear power, and you guys don't want that. So only crazed warmongers and the Mossad could possibly oppose this plan. And, you know, as the Trump administration very gradually worked its way towards scrapping the Iran deal, there was a question, all right, so what's your plan? What's the alternative? Well, now we see it. We see Plan B, and that is to maximize pressure on Iran through as many venues as possible, but most notably through economic sanctions. And one of the things that's worth noting, and one of the reasons people made the argument against the Iran deal as it was working out throughout the tail end of the Obama administration and into the first years of the Trump administration, was the sense that we were seeing zero change in Iran's behavior. And if anything, it was getting more aggressive. The deal had emboldened Iran. It was becoming more, exerting more power and more influence throughout the region. And a lot of this was generated because of the economic activity that was suddenly allowed because of the lifting of the sanctions. I think Ed's assessment that this proposal, this speech, this whole layout of the foreign policy vision of the Trump administration is really geared towards Europe and to say, look, guys, you were the ones who were really eager to lift the sanctions. You were the ones who really wanted to get back in business with Tehran. And you basically made the contention that this was going to improve things. Well, it has not improved things. And we want to go back to the circumstances that actually brought Iran to the negotiating table in the first place. Put pressure on them, put them in a situation where they have to choose between guns and butter. We've already seen several uprisings of the Iranian people. And the good question is, what is your policy geared towards? Is it geared towards the Iranian regime or is it geared towards the Iranian people? As I was thinking about the everything that Pompeo had laid out, I was reminded of the Stephen Covey slogan, begin with the end in mind. Think about what your end goal is. And it seemed like for the previous administration, the end goal was a deal, to be able to say, we have come to the negotiating table with the Iranian mullahs, and despite what all those terrible Republicans had said, despite what the Bush administration has said, we found them reasonable. And look at this reasonable agreement we came to, that we've achieved without actually getting a nuclear-free Iran. And that's not, you know, all it really did was delay it, kick the can down the road for 11 years. And in the meantime, it was giving Iran a lot more financial resources that they could dump into missile testing and finding terrorist groups in Yemen and all these other areas in which they want to exert their influence and power. No policy has any guarantee of success, but it is nice to see an administration laying out a policy that's designed to weaken the Iranian regime, that doesn't see them as partners for peace, that doesn't keep emphasizing, oh, these guys are reasonable, we can reach a reasonable accommodation and a deal with these guys. You know, it'll be interesting to see whether Europe is persuaded by this. You have the sneaking suspicion that they find these deals with Iran as profitable as well. And the other thing is interesting, every once in a while, the Iranian regime will say things like, well, if you guys break back out of the deal, we will expose our payments to you. That effectively bribe you into going along with this deal. I don't know if the Iranians grasp how much that's an argument against their own interests. And it basically argues that the only reason the Iran deal came about is because they bribed people into supporting them. Now, it's Iran. They could be lying. They could be exaggerating. They could be doing this to try to create dissension and division in the West. But I don't know about you, Greg. I would not be shocked to find that some voices who eagerly promoted the Iran deal, either here or in Europe, turned out to be getting a little bit of, you know, money on the side from the Iranian regime.
Oh, that would be delicious. Yeah, please, mullahs, don't reveal who you paid off to get this deal done. That would be so bad.
Yeah, don't throw us into that briar patch while you're at it, too.
Oh, man, this could get real fun. All right, let's move on to our bad martini, Jim. And once again, we're talking about a horrific school shooting. 8 students dead, 2 teachers dead. Santa Fe High School, about half an hour south of Houston. The news broke just as we were starting to record on Friday, so we weren't in a position to comment intelligently on what had happened. Obviously, we've had a chance to digest a lot of the information since then. And the bad martini today is pretty simple. It's that the gun control debate and the debate that almost automatically ensues and almost instantaneously ensues after a horrific event like this hasn't changed, regardless of the facts in this case. The main arguments being made by the gun control crowd is that we need stiffer background checks, and we need to certainly ban military-looking type guns like the AR-15, but maybe even all semi-automatics. Well, in this case, this kid, who shall remain nameless, and even if I wanted to name him, I probably couldn't pronounce it, even though he looks like a Greek name, he stole the guns from his dad. It was a handgun and a shotgun, and nonetheless, all the talking points remain the same.
Indeed, Greg, and I wrote about this extensively in the Morning Jolt today, and I hadn't even mentioned the fact that he was using a revolver and he was using a shotgun, and those are two guns that not even Dianne Feinstein wants to ban. We are constantly told by gun control advocates that they aren't calling for a repeal of the Second Amendment, or at least in most cases, and that they don't want to ban all private ownership of guns. Well, banning all private ownership of guns is really the only way you would reach the point where there would not be revolvers and shotguns in the hands of the public. What I really keep, every time you'll have these awful mass shootings, people on the left will generally say it's time to have that discussion about gun control, even though it feels like, no, actually, we've had this discussion about gun control over and over and over again. You guys just don't win the argument. That's why you feel like we haven't had the discussion. We've debated this many, many times over, and the public has a great deal of skepticism. Yes, you can point to certain polling numbers, but basically they're demonstrating that support for gun control is about a mile wide and an inch deep. Maybe that's changing, but the polling numbers, at least after Parkland, did not, you know, went back to the median, you could say. But what's more is that usually people on the right say we need to talk about mental health. We need to talk about the psychology and what leads to these shootings. And it feels like, I don't know about you, Greg, I feel like we never really have that conversation. And the other thing that I think really needs to be front and center, and I'd really love to see a serious discussion, not just on cable TV of people shouting at each other, but amongst lawmakers, but amongst local lawmakers, school administrators, all kinds of groups. Like, so why are we seeing teenage boys lash out in violence in a way over problems that by and large seem really commonplace? Look, I'm not going to lie to you and say, you know, getting bullied is a no big deal. You know, anybody who's been bullied knows it feels terrible. It feels like your world's going to end. You don't feel safe. You feel anxiety, all kinds of stuff. Loneliness, depression, isolation, alienation from your peers. My guess is a good portion of the listeners of this podcast think back to their teenage years and cringe and remember all of those feelings. What's kind of striking is that these are, if not completely universal, then almost universal. The teenage years are difficult for everyone. And yet some segment of teenage boys today dealing with getting rejected by a girl, dealing with not feeling like they have enough friends, not feeling like they're part of the in crowd, feeling like nobody understands them, feeling like they, you know, that they all of a sudden find themselves deciding the only way I can deal with this is by taking a gun to school and trying to kill as many people as possible. Or in the case of this one in Texas, improvised explosive devices. I mean, that kind of shows the absurdity of focusing on guns after this. This kid was building bombs, right? We just had a bomber else in Austin not that long ago. What is making young men so angry that they feel the only way to deal with their pain and their problems is to try to kill random people? That's the conversation I want to have. And I feel like we always kind of get glossed over on this in favor of, oh, what kind of, you know, it's time to ban bump stocks, or, oh, we got to regulate gun shows and all these other things which feel really extraneous, to the point that something is motivating more and more people to lash out like this. Now, my colleague David French has a really depressing but well-written piece where he talks about, he kind of looks at the research by Malcolm Gladwell, the idea of a threshold, the idea that there's only a certain number of people who would throw a rock through a window if nobody else is doing it. You know, it's like one in a million. People who ordinarily would not do something to initiate violence against property. But there's a certain number of people who would do it if somebody else does it. And if you see multiple people doing it, more people, oh, okay, if everybody else is throwing rocks through windows, I will do that too. These cascading thresholds of what kind of violence people are willing to partake in. And you kind of wonder how many troubled, angry young men are looking at these sorts of school shootings and thinking, oh, that's what I do if I feel this angry. That's what I do if I feel this isolated and alienated and don't connect to anyone. Also, I think worth noting is it was a Washington Post study that found that CNN study that said 26 of the 27 largest mass shooters were not raised by their biological fathers. This by itself does not say if there's not a father in the home, the kid's going to grow up to be a school shooter. Lots of people can go through tough family situations like that and turn out okay. I think what's an indisputable factor here is that in a lot of these cases, you have a young, angry male with no male role model and no one they feel they can talk to, no one they feel who will understand them and they'll be able to talk about whatever's bothering them. So I'd really love to see a national conversation on this. I really feel like that's much closer to the appropriate response and the one that will prevent this from happening again, rather than debating the gun show loophole for the millionth time. But I don't know about you, Greg. I don't think we're going to get that conversation anytime soon.
But, Jim, you can't fit that into 280 characters. So how's that going to work?
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, we need some adults on the job, regardless whether it's political, in the home, in the church, in the schools, whatever. And you want the best people on the job. And let's broaden that out to getting the best people for any job. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than just posting your job online and then crossing your fingers and hoping for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way to do this, so they built the platform that finds the right job candidates for you.
ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and then it invites them to apply to your job. These innovations have revolutionized how you can find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive, so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there, and ZipRecruiter is how you find them.
They couldn't have made this easier for you. They get the people to find you. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, 3 Martini Lunch listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/martini. That's ZipRecruiter.com/martini. ZipRecruiter.com/martini. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Do it now. By the time you hear tomorrow's podcast, you'll have the job filled probably. All right, Jim, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And here's a guy we thought we might be done with, but we're not quite done with him yet. Politico, West Virginia coal baron and former prisoner Don Blankenship announced on Monday that he plans to launch a long-shot third-party Senate bid after finishing a distant third in this month's Republican primary. Blankenship said he would run in the general election as the Constitution Party nominee. but he would need to overcome a sore loser law in West Virginia that prevents failed candidates in a main party primary from refiling to run in the general election under another party's banner. Blankenship said he's prepared to challenge that law in court if needed. If he's successful, his move could hurt the GOP's prospects of unseating Democratic incumbent Joe Manchin in November. He says, quote, "It is especially appropriate for me to be nominated by the Constitution Party, given its staunch and uncompromising commitment to upholding the United States Constitution," Blankenship said, apparently except for the part about following the law. The guidebook for 2018 candidates posted on the West Virginia Secretary of State's website states, "Candidates affiliated with a recognized political party who run for election in a primary election and who lose the nomination cannot change her or his voter registration to a minor party organization or unaffiliated candidate to take advantage of the later filing deadlines and have their name on the subsequent general election ballot." So he got squashed by Cocaine Mitch and Patrick Morrissey, and now it looks like the law is probably going to trip up Don Blankenship. But what do you make of the fact that he's trying to forge his way onto the ballot anyway?
Well, I was going to say, Greg, this isn't the first time Don Blankenship has been in trouble with the law in West Virginia. Talking about the failure to obey safety laws at his mines that got a whole bunch of miners killed. Coal miners, not underage miners. I really wish this is what happens when rich people get involved in politics. They've been surrounded by yes men their entire lives, surrounded by sycophants. No one can speak honestly to them. And when someone does speak honestly to them, they just kind of reject it. There's such enormous narcissism there. They can't possibly have been wrong. Somebody who knows Don Blankenship and cares about him, who he has some degree of trust with, if that person exists, needs to pull him over, sit him down and say, "Don, I hate to tell you this, but you're a terrible candidate. You're just a terrible, terrible candidate. Your messaging is bad. He's not Cocaine Mitch. Your commercials are more awkward than hostage videotapes. No one is persuaded. No one believes you'd be great. People still resent you for the mine disaster. No one believes you when you say you believe in upholding the law and the Constitution. No one thinks that China person is an okay term. No one thinks that's not trying to demonize Mitch McConnell. You're basically playing to anti-Asian bias or racism. So you're just really bad at this. That's why you came in third. It wasn't the nefarious doings of Cocaine Mitch. It wasn't a grand conspiracy. The voters don't like you. And you know what else? The law about sore losers is specifically designed to stop people like you. If it could be any more specific, it would have been stop Don Blankenship from running for another party category, law of 2018 or whatever it was. It's specifically designed for circumstances like this. So I don't think his legal challenge will be successful. In fact, I think I'd say that if he does succeed in it, you might as well get rid of the law. I don't understand why. This seems like exactly the circumstance that law is designed for. That's who he is. And maybe this is the sort of thing, the only way Don Blankenship can learn is by losing, legal challenge after legal challenge. I'm remembering, Greg, wasn't Roy Moore going to do this big recount because of all the voter fraud down in Alabama, right?
Yeah, he's still working on that.
He had actually won, but there was this nefarious conspiracy to bus in people from out of state, and that's how he lost. The idea that these guys are regular, maybe you're just bad at this, never crosses their mind, and they're just in flat-out denial. And I just am frustrated that those of us in the rest of the world who have to live our lives have to go through all of this. No doubt this is a news story. No doubt this is, worthy of at least a little bit of attention, but let's face it, crazy guy continues to act crazy would be every bit as applicable a headline for this story.
Yes. And once again, well done, West Virginia Republicans. You got the right guy as your nominee. So he's already ahead in the polls, and hopefully it stays that way. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And do not forget to visit our good friends over at ZipRecruiter. If you need to fill a job, they can find the right person to respond and find you fast. ZipRecruiter.com/martini. And tune in again Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.